From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 2 years and counting after the invasion of Iraq and the toppling of Saddam Hussein, there is an unsettling new message coming out of Iraq. Vice President Dick Cheney said 2 weeks ago that the insurgency there was in its last throes. But the word from top U.S. military officials in Iraq and in Washington is that the conflict has devolved into a classic guerrilla war. Chief U.S. military spokesman in Iraq, Brigadier General Donald Alston, said last week that the insurgency cannot be settled through military options or operations. That message is echoing loudly in Washington, where Republicans and Democrats, fueled by fresh poll results indicating waning public support for the war, are pushing the White House to offer a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops. But there's no indication that Iraq's government or its fledgling military can fill the power vacuum if the U.S. draws down its forces. And hope for a political solution seems always out of reach, which begs the unthinkable question, what if the Iraq war cannot be won? Tonight on Point, defining victory and defining defeat in Iraq. We begin tonight in Iraq, where today a suicide bomber killed 23 Iraqis in the northern city of Kirkuk, the worst single attack in that tense northern city since the fall of Saddam. Insurgents killed two U.S. soldiers in Baghdad and more in Anbar province. Five Iraqi guardsmen died at an army checkpoint. A surge in violence since Iraq's elections has prompted top U.S. brass to question the ability of military force to bring the insurgents to heel. Tom Lassiter is correspondent for Knight Ridder newspapers in Baghdad. I asked him earlier what the U.S. military is so worried, why it's so worried about its ultimate effectiveness in Iraq.
Well, I think you have to draw a distinction. They're not glum about their military capabilities. There's no question that the U.S. military could take any town in Iraq that it wants. I think there is, though, a growing realization that to have sustained progress, sort of sustained motion, that you have to have a political process that's functioning, and a particularly political process that brings to the table the nation's sitting minority, 20% of the population, which, because of the dynamic of the former dictator Saddam Hussein, who was a Sunni, the Sunnis hold much of the country's military technological know-how. They make up the backbone of the insurgency right now, and as long as that continues to happen, it's hard to see peace anytime soon. And so I think there's a growing realization of the importance of the political component and wanting the Sunnis to come into the fold.
Vice President Cheney said just a couple of weeks ago on Memorial Day that the insurgency in Iraq was in its last throes. Is there any evidence of that? How has the military responded there to that? They seem to be speaking very differently about it.
What the military says, and recently in speaking with military officials, they say it often, is that the enemy has a vote, which means that it is hard to predict, especially with an insurgency as diffuse as the one in Iraq. And if you're saying that when you say insurgency, this isn't just one group, there's not sort of a RICO chart with the dawn of the insurgency on top. This is really a diffuse group of groups, many of which have very different motivations. A Ba'athist loyalist has very different motivations than a Wahhabi jihadist, for example. I think the military is very cognizant of the complexity of the insurgency that they face, and also that, frankly, many of the insurgents' tactics, such as bombs on the side of the road, are just hard to fight. And suicide bombers are also really difficult to fight.
It wasn't so long ago U.S. military officials were talking about drawing down the level of U.S. forces in Iraq, perhaps later this year, and putting Iraqi forces more to the fore. How is the train-up of the Iraqi army doing?
Iraqi security forces, I don't think there's any question, are far more confident than they were when they began. They began as the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps, and I think everyone would agree that many of those ICDC groups were fairly hapless. The groups that you deal with now, there's a real variety of quality, but you have some units, the units on Haifa Street in Baghdad, for example, really just a vast improvement over their predecessors. But the question is not whether they can fight at a platoon-sized element. The way you fight counterinsurgencies is not just at the platoon level. You need a lot of organization, and you need a much broader spectrum of planning. And that's what's missing the Iraqi security forces right now. And that's where you really get into the conversation about at what point will Iraqi security forces be able to go forward. That's definitely something that they're still working through. And in a lot of places in Iraq, that higher level of organization, that command and control, as the military would call it, is really lacking. And that will really be the key for those guys to move to the front of the fight.
On the political front, there was some hope this week that talks with some elements of the Sunni community might lead to the negotiated settlement with some of the insurgents. Has anything come of that?
No, not that I'm aware of. You have to remember that this was a conversation that also took place when Al-Awlaki got into government, where they talked about sort of peace through amnesty, and then there was a good deal of argument about who will you give amnesty to? People with American blood on their hands, people with Iraqi blood on their hands, people with no blood on their hands. It didn't really move forward. You know, I guess the best way to put it is, so far, there's not anyone in the public sphere that is able to deliver the Sunnis en masse, and certainly not the insurgency en masse. There's just such a division within the Sunni community with all these disparate groups who really disagree with each other. And that's just talking political groups that really disagree with each other. And then when you move into who could speak for the insurgency or who could speak for even a particular insurgent group, it becomes very complicated.
Deep conflict, and as you write, no long-term military solution. Tom, I know it's late there. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Tom Lasseter is correspondent for Knight Ridder newspapers. He spoke with me from Baghdad. We are talking tonight about the Iraq War and where it is headed. You can join the conversation. Is this a war that the U.S. can win? If the insurgency doesn't go away and Iraq doesn't achieve stability, does that mean defeat? Are you on board for the long haul, or are you looking for the exits? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Brian Bender, national security reporter for the Boston Globe. He's been writing about deepening skepticism on the war effort being expressed by U.S. military officials and observers. Brian Bender, thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure.
We're also joined tonight from London, England, by Rod Nordland. He is correspondent at large for Newsweek and has been Baghdad bureau chief for the magazine for the last 2 years. He left his Baghdad post in May. Rod Nordland, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Brian Bender, if I may go first to you. You had a fairly arresting story on page one of the Globe last week saying that military operations in Iraq have not succeeded in weakening the insurgency, and quoting lots of people saying they don't think they're going to, that the military force of the United States, big as it is, with everything that's been poured in there, is not going to do it.
Well, there's no doubt that 2+ years since the U.S. invaded, the insurgents' attacks have not really reduced. In fact, in some cases, it looks like they've increased. Now, certainly, there have been some dips along the way. For example, when the U.S. invaded the insurgent stronghold of Fallujah last fall, following that, there was a reduction in some attacks, but within a few months, they rose back up again. And I think what many military officials are coming to grips with is, as Tom mentioned in the earlier segment, the real solution here is not a military one, it's a political one. If you can't bring the Sunni Iraqis into the political fold, the population that, for the most part, has been supporting the insurgency, then it's going to be this cat-and-mouse game, sort of like a gerbil running around on a wheel, till the end of time. That it's a large country, the enemy is a thinking enemy. It changes its strategy whenever the U.S. and the Iraqi security forces change theirs. And it's a guerrilla war. It's something that bedeviled the U.S. and Vietnam for years. The U.S. is great at destroying an enemy army or navy or air force, but not an enemy that hides among the population and doesn't wear a uniform.
So there's what we're up against. Rod Nordland, I'm sure it turned your head when Vice President Dick Cheney said May 31st that the insurgency in Iraq was in its last throes. Brian Bender quotes Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution saying that is the most extreme form of wishful thinking. But that's what our Vice President was saying. How does that line up with reality or not?
Well, it just made me laugh, you know, because I've heard that over and over again over the last 2 years. Beginning back around July 2003, when there was a small spate of kind of early insurgent attacks, and then they were saying it was the last gasp of the dead enders in the Saddam elements, and they've been saying that ever since. Whenever there's been a spike in attacks by the insurgents, they explain it away by saying it's just one last desperate gamble. You know, they said that after Fallujah, they said it after the election period when things started spiking again. And you know, you think that Cheney at least would be a little more sophisticated than that at this point. And it's also something that people in our own government do not believe anymore, not thinking people who are involved in following events there, certainly not the military.
Rod, let me ask you, we went into this fight with the sense that once we were in, whatever the basis was, that the United States had to win. This was a critical region, a critical conflict right there on top of all that oil, that we had to win. And now it seems possible that maybe we're not going to, or does it feel that way in Iraq?
I think the question is more, you know, not so much a question of winning, but how long are we going to have to stay there before the Iraqis are able to do it themselves?
Do you mean by that it is only a matter of time until there's a stable, peaceful Iraq? That was the goal. Is that what you're suggesting? It's just time?
Oh, I think that's true, but I think we're talking about a very, very long time. Certainly not a year. Certainly not, you know, probably not a couple of years even, but many years. I mean, look at Bosnia. There's still Western troops in Bosnia now, and everyone agrees that if they left, you know, it's been 10 years there. If they left, you know, tomorrow, the next day, there would be civil war again. And I think that, you know, Iraq is a much bigger country with a lot more at stake than Bosnia. And I think we just have to face the fact that we're going to be there for a very long time. Or if we leave precipitously, we're going to leave behind us a horrendous civil war and probably mass slaughter, something that would you know, forever redound to our discredit.
Rod Nordland in London, Brian Bender in Washington. Please stand by. We're talking tonight about the war in Iraq and whether it is winnable. You can join the conversation. What do you think? If the insurgency is not going away and Iraq is not achieving stability, is that a defeat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the war in Iraq and whether it's winnable and how long that might take. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Will more time and money and American blood make the difference? Will they bring victory? And how do you explain the gap between Dick Cheney saying the insurgency is in its last throes and U.S. military brass in Iraq saying there is no military solution? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Newsweek's Rod Nordland. He's in London tonight. He's just come out of Iraq after a two-year posting that there. Picture that, my friends. And Brian Bender is with us from Washington, D.C. He's national security reporter for the Boston Globe. We'll be joined in a minute by former Marine Corps General Bernard Traynor. Brian Bender, you spoke with a lot of people in Washington about what's going on in Iraq and where it's headed. Give us a sense of how they see the conflict and prospects for a successful conclusion.
Well, I think, obviously, there's no widespread agreement on where things are headed. In fact, that's probably the main problem, which is the Bush administration, and to a lesser extent, perhaps the Congress, have not really done a good job of defining what victory actually is. Is victory military victory? Is it destroying or capturing every last insurgent in Iraq? Probably not, because that's probably not possible. I think the conventional wisdom is becoming, again, that a military victory is not achievable, at least anytime soon, and if it ever were to be, the only way you're going to reach that is, again, by the Iraqis themselves finding some sort of reconciliation between these ethnic and tribal divisions.
But, Brian, let me ask you about that. Yeah, let me ask you about that, if I may. It doesn't seem long ago, unless I got this wrong, my sense was that Washington was saying the U.S. military, increasingly with Iraqi military's help, will open up a space for security, stability, politics in Iraq. And now the formula seems to be reversed. The military, General Casey in Iraq and others, kind of saying, no, we need politics to bail out the military effort. We need politics to make stability possible. Kind of reversal of emphasis here. Do you hear that, Brian?
I guess you could look at it as a reversal of emphasis, or simply more of a realization that the two go hand in hand, that it's not one or the other. You're right. Initially, it was, well, the U.S. military will train the Iraqis and will help buy time for the politics to get underway. And there's no doubt, to some extent, they've done that. The Iraqis have had an election. They have put together a government, the first democratic government ever, really. It's certainly still in its infancy, but the military has bought some time. I think what they've realized is there's only so much time we can buy without some real significant progress on the political side. We need to move from these elections to a constitution, to including the Sunnis in this process, because, again, the two go hand in hand. The insurgency is supported largely by a political bloc that feels alienated, and unless you deal with that, you can be as successful as you want in individual engagements with the insurgents, but ultimately you're not going to win.
Rod Nordlund, you've just come from 2 years in Iraq. That's a long time. And you write on your way out that living and working in Iraq, it's hard not to succumb to despair. A lot of talk this week about a political solution where perhaps the military, even the United States military, cannot find one. What's your level of confidence that the Shia and the Sunni are going to work this out so we can all hold hands or at least have some bearable level of stability and security in Iraq?
Well, you know, on January 30th, when they had, you know, a remarkably successful election, much more successful than almost anybody expected.
It was terrific, yeah.
It was terrific. And, you know, at that point, it just seemed maybe that it was possible. And then what happened, it took them more than 3 months to form a cabinet, which they've only fairly recently done. And leaving them only about a month and a half now to write, you know, a constitution, a much more difficult process than choosing a consensus cabinet. Mm. And unless they do that, they're not going to be able to move the political process forward in any meaningful way. Now, they are making efforts to bring the Sunnis in, and that's certainly positive. And the Shia leadership has been very wise in doing everything they can to try to bring the Sunnis in. But it's a hard slog, and it's hard to imagine them seceding in this time frame. I think the best we can kind of hope for is that they'll go for the 6 month extension from August.
To draft the Constitution, and, yes.
Yes, they can opt mm-hmm. to extend the process another 6 months and go into 2006 and then have elections sometime around the middle of 2006. But that's, you know, even that might not work. And it's, you know, it's something that you look at it and you just despair, especially if you're talking about getting out. Going back to an earlier point you were making, you know, your guest was making, you know, the military for a long time now has not been talking about winning in Iraq. You know, even local commanders, they don't talk about winning. They talk about accomplishing their mission, and they define that as narrowly as possible, and they always accomplish their mission. And if you define it as, you know, very narrowly, that's pretty easy to do. Mostly their mission now is for self-protection, and they are doing a better job of that than they had before.
You know? I want to clarify that. By that you mean defending themselves, staying alive in Iraq. You write that now their primary mission is self-defense at any cost, which only deepens Iraqis' resentment. That doesn't sound like the mission that President Bush continues to lay out.
Right, but that's been their mission now for a long time, and it's increasingly so, and it's effective in terms of keeping the body count down, and important. That's important. For the administration politically, it was particularly important in the run-up to the election.
And for the families of all the soldiers there, yeah.
For the families of the soldiers and so on. But it isn't making friends with the Iraqis, and it's not solving things on the ground. I'm not sure that they can solve things on the ground, even if they had a more robust posture. It's a lot more complicated than that, but nonetheless, you know, it's certainly not winning any hearts and minds among our friends.
Rod Nordlund in London, Brian Bender in Washington, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation retired General Bernard Traynor. He joins us from Sterling, Virginia tonight. He was a 3-star Marine Corps general. General Traynor, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
We're trying to make sense of what we're looking at here, General. We could use your military eye on this. We're hearing from the military there's not going to be a military solution to this insurgency. We need a political solution. Then we hear the political solution looks incredibly difficult and maybe even just downright unlikely. And then we hear the United States' main mission in Iraq now has become self-defense, keeping the casualties down. Is there a – do you see the makings of a victory in all this somewhere, General Traynor?
Tom, what you just described kind of is a picture of disarray, isn't it?
It feels that way. Tell us if we're wrong.
Well, we won a victory 2 years ago. That was a military victory, but we haven't been doing very well in winning the peace thereafter. We're not in charge of the situation. We're not masters of it right now. We have a tiger by the tail and don't know how to let go. I think in their heart of hearts, the administration that talked about rearranging the Middle East and getting at terrorism, I think probably have come down to the nub that their real interest at this point is making sure that Iraq does not become a hornet's nest of terrorist activity that can be exported, which was part of their original rationale. But given that as a fundamental objective, I think at this particular point they don't care what sort of government emerges from this sort of thing, as long as it is not a government which will allow the export of terrorism, and that may be the best they can get.
So you're describing victory being defined way down.
I'm saying that there's no such thing as victory in this particular instance. The United States is irrelevant in the struggle that's going on in Iraq right now. This is a power struggle within the so-called nation state of Iraq, which is a fiction to begin with. It's made up of so many disparate parts. But these various factions are all in a struggle to at the end of the day, be in charge of that particular territory and its wealth and its influence. And we happen to be there right now, and we're a convenient whipping boy. But in terms of us playing a major role in the final solution to this problem, we're out of the equation. This is something that's going to be settled by the Iraqis one way or another, and they're going to do it by themselves, and they probably do it behind the power of the gun.
General, you're used to dealing with big situations like that. To my ears, that's got a kind of shocking sound to it. I mean, we've got 140,000 troops there, and we're irrelevant. We're out of the equation, but we seem like we're in up to our neck. The casualty rate goes up and up. It seems like you're saying we just want to get out with the U.S. Army still intact and something this side of chaos there.
Well, we've done this before. We did this in Vietnam, and everybody said that the sky was going to fall if we pulled out of Vietnam because of the domino theory, and that didn't happen, and now it's nothing more than a bit of memory. And all crises have a beginning, middle, and the end, and the question is, where are we on that particular continuum right now? But yes, the United States is irrelevant in terms of the power struggle that's going on within Iraq, with the various factions, and not only religious factions and ethnic factions, but even tribal groupings, trying to position themselves in the best fashion at the end of the day when the American troops eventually do leave.
General, we left Vietnam with defeat hung around our necks. Do you see that happening in Iraq, or can it be redefined so that we go out heads high?
Well, defeat is a subjective term. I'm not so sure when you look back on it. Yeah, we withdrew, and I suppose one could question whether we should have gotten in there in the first place, and I'm not going to discuss that aspect of it.
Sure, but it sure felt like defeat at the time. It was very humbling for this country.
Well, it will be humbling in this instance, too, if we, after all the rhetoric that came from the administration and others, that we pull out with something short of a democratic, a Wilsonian regime out in the area. But I don't think that's in the... I don't think that's in the cards, and we better settle for the best we can possibly get, because once again, we are not the determining factor as to the outcome of this struggle. We are only one of the players, and as they say, we're an irrelevant player in terms of the power struggle that's going on within the country itself.
Well, this is one amazing picture, given the language we went in with. We've got a great panel tonight. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jim is calling from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hi, Jim. What do you think?
I just wanted to comment. I've been in Bosnia, Afghanistan, and Iraq.
In what capacity, Jim?
Are you
as a soldier, okay.
Yes. And the thing that I've seen over and over is, as soon as the spotlight isn't on that area, everyone seems to forget about the fact that we still have people dying in Kosovo and Bosnia. We were in Germany still to this day after that war. We're still in Southeast Asia. So the military that we have doesn't just, okay, we've won, it's time to leave. We have bases all around the world based on victories that we've had to maintain stability. we will always be required to keep some military force in these countries.
But, Jim, we're spending billions a month to stay in Iraq and still losing soldiers in a deep self-defense posture. Can the United States, your soldier, can the U.S. afford to stay there indefinitely?
Well, we're going to have to stay there for at least a certain amount of time. And the thing about it is we are developing stability. We have handed it over to where they're starting to be able to make their own government. And the thing is, the majority of people who are being killed now are being killed by insurgents that are coming in from other countries, and they're killing Iraqi civilians because they don't want to hit the hard targets. And the U.S. is a hard target over there. And having us there helps make it harder for the insurgents. Also, if we're fighting terrorists on that side of the pond, we don't have to worry about doing it here in our own backyard.
Okay, you've given us a lot to chew on there, Jim. Thanks for your call. Rod Norden, let me go to you first. Several things there. Number one, the U.S. has developed stability in Iraq. What do you think of that? Number two, the insurgents are coming in from other countries. And third, by fighting there, we don't have to fight in the U.S. What do you say?
Well, you know, I mean, what we've done, first of all, to take the last point first, what we've done in Iraq is created what we supposedly went in there to prevent, which is a nest of terrorism, a breeding ground for terrorism. There are more terrorists in Iraq now than any place else in the world, and there are more coming all the time. You know, it's become the Mecca, if you will, for everybody who wants to kill Americans.
And we've had Pentagon officials saying as much, that they're worried about this becoming an incubator at this point.
Well, it has, and it wasn't before. There were some relations between Saddam's government and certain terrorist groups, but he very much kept them under control and used them in a very sparing way, and he wasn't exporting terrorism in any major degree, except for his own interest to occasionally assassinate opponents abroad and so on.
The insurgents coming in from abroad, do you buy that?
Sure. They're a major factor. And,
like majority, and predominant, or not? Predominant, majority?
Well, it's complicated. They're a major factor, and they're certainly predominant in the insurgency's most effective weapon, which is the suicide bomber. There's no evidence that any Iraqi has ever been a suicide bomber. People have been able to determine who the bombers were, it's turned out to be Syrians or Saudis or some other nationals. And I think everyone, you know, pretty much accepts that that's true. And the expertise for running those suicide bombers, the expertise behind videotaping the beheadings of hostages and the whole propaganda campaign that Al-Qaeda runs there is all foreign. But they've been married with local insurgents, local Sunnis for the most part, and former regime elements who are all finding common cause in fighting the Americans. And it's a very ruthless and extremely effective formula and alliance that we're facing.
And finally, Jim, saying the U.S. has brought stability to Iraq. I mean, you've seen a lot. You saw the election in January that felt great for everybody. Is it fair to say the United States has brought stability there?
No, it hasn't. It's gotten rid of Saddam, which is certainly a plus. Everyone pretty much agrees on that, with the exception of a few diehards. But the country's hardly anywhere near as stable as it had been. You know, people aren't safe in their homes. They don't have electricity for the most part. They don't have basic services. You can hardly say the country is more stable for our presence there. There's a very big difference between Iraq and Afghanistan and Bosnia. In Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, we were there with the consent of the majority of the parties, with people on both sides who were basically in favor of our being there, and we don't have that consent from a very major faction in Iraq, and even our natural allies in Iraq, we've alienated a lot of them, both among the Shia and even among the Kurds.
General Traynor, do you see U.S. bases in Iraq 10 years from now, 20, 30 years from now?
That's hard to say. It depends upon how this thing spins out. I wouldn't see that there was any legitimate reason to have military bases there unless they were invited there by the people within the region for purposes of stability.
Oil, counterterrorism?
Well, I wouldn't think on oil in terms of counterterrorism. I wouldn't think that either. I find it hard to conjure up a legitimate reason why the locals would want foreigners to come into an entirely different culture and in violation of their sovereignty to a certain degree, to take care of things that they're capable of taking care of themselves.
General Bernard Traynor in Virginia, Brian Bender in Washington, Rod Nordland in London. It's great to have all of you with us tonight. We've got to take a short break here. We'll be right back. We're talking about the war in Iraq and whether it's winnable and how long that might take. We're trying to define victory, define defeat. You can join us tonight. Do you see the Iraqi army stepping up to relieve U.S. forces in a significant way anytime soon? Do you see Iraqis finding a political solution? And how would you define success in Iraq? How would you define failure? Which are we closer to right now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the war in Iraq and whether it is winnable. We're joined tonight by Rod Nordland, correspondent at large for Newsweek magazine, former Baghdad bureau chief for 2 years, two tough years in Baghdad. Brian Bender is with us with the Boston Globe national security reporter there. And retired General Bernard Traynor joins us, a former three-star Marine Corps general. You can join us as well. How would you define success in Iraq? How would you define failure? Which are we closer to now? Is pulling out an option for the United States? Is staying in a solution? And is this war winnable? What does that mean? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bill is calling from Waupun, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're good. What do you think?
I think it is winnable, but we're not going to win it with our current philosophy. The United States military is like a football team that on paper looks like just absolutely awesome. All the numbers look fine. But this football team, it's out on the field, and before it launches a play, it asks the opinion of the opposing fans.
Bill, what do you think needs to change in policy? What would you do to win then?
Okay, well, I'm coming from my experiences at working as a counterintelligence specialist, civilian contractor over in Baghdad.
Okay.
Last year. So
give us your formula. Give us your strategy. What needs to change?
There's a number of things you can do. One is we must be much more ruthless in the way we go about things.
What does that mean? I mean, we flattened Fallujah. Should it have been flatter?
No, but I'll give you a specific. The Geneva Convention said spies will be tried and executed. You don't have to prove that they've passed anything. All you have to prove is that they are lurking about a military facility under false pretenses.
You're talking about spies. So spies within the green zone, within the Iraqi military, in the Iraqi government, wherever they might be, take them out and shoot them.
As far as much more directly with us, the people that work on our bases, there are hundreds, if not thousands, that fit that description.
Okay, spies. What else? We're more ruthless.
Okay. You, instead of trying to go out and just capture somebody, if your intel reaches a certain point where you know he's bad, instead of driving down the road where he's got lookouts to give him an early warning so he runs out the back door, drop a bomb on it. And if he's going to use his family to shield him, then the onus is on him for breaking the Geneva Conventions and not fighting in a uniform like a real soldier does.
Okay, Bill, I think we got the gist of that, and let us run with it. Thank you for your call. General Traynor, Bill was there as a counterintelligence officer in Baghdad. He says the solution is to be more ruthless. Find a spy, kill him. Somebody's in a house, bomb the house, whether the family's there or not. Is an iron fist the answer, General?
The draconian approach is one way. You know, we used that in the Philippines at the turn of the century, and it worked. And we know Sherman used that in his march to the sea, and it worked. We know that the French tried that down in Algeria, and it didn't work. Anything you do along those lines, Tom, I think may get you a short-term benefit. But in the long run, notwithstanding the ethical and moral aspect of that sort of thing, in the long run, from a political and a strategic standpoint, you've created a bigger problem than you've solved.
Rod Nordland, let me put the same question to you, because this comes up with some frequency. You've been in Iraq for 2 years. If the U.S. military pulled out the stops, whatever that means, do you see it pushing the situation there closer to a solution, to a victory?
Given their record so far, I think if they pulled out all the stops, they probably would, in most cases, kill the wrong people. I mean, frankly, their intelligence has been a pathetic joke, you know, throughout. I mean, just a couple of quick examples, you know, and they bombed a wedding celebration in Qaim on the border and killed, I forget the exact number, but it was some dozens of people, in the belief that it was an insurgent transit center. People later found, you know, the remains of the wedding party, the bride and the groom, were killed, but a variety of people, like the hired wedding singer and so on, survived to tell the tale. And they were dead certain, and even a subsequent investigation by the military confirmed their intelligence that this was indeed a transit center. That's like the kind of intelligence we've had in Iraq, and a lot of our problems there are precisely because of bad intelligence. As far as getting tough, I mean, you know, look at Abu Ghraib. What did that do us? It completely alienated the vast majority of Iraqis, who are forever after convinced that we're just not to be trusted and completely anathema to everything they believe in.
You call that the biggest turning point for the worse in the Iraq war. Do you see, Rod, in general, did you see Americans acting with kid gloves in Iraq? Is that the right way to see what's going on there?
I think, yes, in many cases, lots of individual Americans have. And in the beginning, in fact, one of the things that we did wrong was be too gentle with looters. You know, we rushed into Baghdad and didn't have enough troops to secure the rear and didn't have enough troops to police the streets, although we had disbanded the police force and Iraqi security forces. And the result was widespread looting, and the order came down from the American military not to use deadly force to stop looting. And most Iraqis would have been delighted if we had done that. And in fact, they took that as a sign that we wanted to destroy the country by allowing looters to run rampant, and that our real goal was to subvert their whole governing structure so that we could run away with all their oil, a fairy tale that's widely believed by almost all Iraqis now.
Brian Bender, you quote U.S. estimates that U.S. forces in Iraq kill or capture between 1,000 and 3,000 insurgents every month, and yet the number of daily attacks is spiking up very high. Do you hear in Washington grumbling in military ranks that the U.S. isn't being tough enough, that it should bomb more, be more ruthless, bring an iron fist to it?
I don't hear that, and I think it's for the reasons we just heard, that it would probably alienate more people than have already been alienated by the U.S. Military presence. But also, at the same time, there's no doubt that numbers tell at least a piece of the story, how many attacks per week. But even though the military from time to time puts out those figures, or, for example, at the end of a certain battle, we'll say we killed X amount of insurgents. Privately, a lot of military officers will say, don't pay attention to any of that because it really doesn't mean anything. That, again, this is about winning hearts and minds. It's about the Iraqis, much more so than the Americans, finding some sort of common ground. And if you get too bogged down in the numbers, you sort of miss the whole point. And that was one of the criticisms of the Vietnam War,
right,
which was
body,
you know,
counts and meant nothing.
Follies. The Pentagon every day would say we killed X amount of Viet Cong, and it turned out in the end that it really didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But on your first point, in terms of getting tougher, I don't hear anybody talking about that. In fact, if anything, you start to hear people talking about how do we get out, or how do we at least reduce our presence and, you know, basically take a chance and hope and help as much as possible, but hope that the Iraqi government gets its legs and can deal with this on its own, which it's going to have to do in the long term anyway.
Forget getting tougher. How do we get out? Kati is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Kati, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. I think there are two important things to focus on. The first is strengthen what we have. You have this nascent Iraqi military that's just growing right now.
Yes.
And I think it's extremely important. I think that one way of defining success is creating stability, or at least creating stability in so much as you have a military that can maintain some semblance of stability.
Everybody seems to be on board with that, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think the focus should be less on the insurgents and more on strengthening what will maintain the peace, which is the nascent army. And so I would define success as being able to do that. And also, another way of strengthening the army is not only by providing it training, but also by providing it with alternative, I think, conflict resolution skills. For example, the police force in Northern Ireland has this. And what this prepares them to deal with the differences between the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds. One point of primary contention right now is in Kirkuk, which has been called a tinderbox. Because you have, you know, the very populations that I mentioned, the Shia.
Cardi, do you really think that, you know, that confrontation, diminishment techniques, I mean, did you see the pictures of the bombing there today? Does that look like a place where a little psychotherapy would work?
Right, but I think there's a tremendous difference between psychotherapy and training an army in not only the ability to be strong, but also the ability to perceive when it's appropriate to be strong and to perceive when it's appropriate to be able to negotiate your way out of a situation. For example, for example, the American military could also benefit from that. Many of the military don't know Arabic, and if they perceive a threat, are more likely to shoot an oncoming offender than they are to be able to engage in alternative methods of trying to mediate the conflict, which is what's led the American military into a lot of difficult situations and has increased anti-Americanism.
Yeah, we can see that. But a long road on a strict conflict resolution path, I would think. Though in the end, you're right, that's what we need. Rod, Cotty raises the issue of the Iraqi army and the necessity of having that up and ready to go. We've seen multiple reports in recent days that, despite the growing numbers, is very far from being a reality.
The numbers look good on paper, and even the level of equipment and to a lesser degree the level of training has been improving, and particularly equipment has improved a lot. And there are some instances where they've done a pretty credible job, but there are a lot more instances where they've proven ineffective. And probably the bigger concern about the Iraqi security forces is that they're predominantly Shia and Kurds in many areas, and they're increasingly seen by the Sunnis as ethnic armies or ethnic forces. And then combined with that has been the Shiite dominated government's decision to or an announced sort of view that they want to promote and maintain some of the major militias, particularly Shia militias,
outside the formal military structure.
Right. Mm-hmm. And or even in some cases
integrated,
supposedly integrated mm-hmm. into the military, but not in a way that makes it a real national army. And all those things are very long-term concerns. I don't think anybody in their right mind, including Iraqi leaders, thinks that they're anywhere near getting to the point where they can take over the job from the Americans, that it's going to be a very long time before that happens.
General Traynor, what do you hear out of the military? We read now 169,000 Iraqi troops, 107 battalions, but only 3 battalions fully operational. How long till they can take over the burden of security in Iraq?
Well, Tom, it's been, I think, disappointing up at this point. We've had a number of false starts. I think wasted a lot of time in trying to develop a capable army and security force, and it's moving very, very slowly. And I think that the best you can hope for in this situation is that there is some sort of security and military force that can bring reasonable security to the regions, and that you have some sort of a compromised government that can keep factional groups from going at each other's throat. And I think that's about the best you can hope for. And as that develops, then slowly withdraw the American forces. But American forces can't come out of there unless those two minimum requirements are met. And I think it's questionable at this point, as I go back to what I said at the beginning mm-hmm. in the final analysis, mm-hmm. it may be we'll have to settle with some sort of a solution and hope that Iraq, whatever emerges, is not going to be the source of exporting terrorism to the United States. And in terms of humiliation and so forth, well, if that happens, we'll just have to live with it and get over it. But the situation right now, I think, is on the cusp. It could go either way. I'm hopeful that we can develop the requisite military forces and security forces and some sort of a reasonably acceptable government to reduce the burden on us and let us start to withdraw the forces. But I'm not betting on that right now.
Pray for that, but certainly no sure thing. A long way from it. Chris is calling from Clayton, North Carolina. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to make a comment that I definitely think that this war is something that we have to win. We must win.
And what do you mean by win, Chris?
Well, I think it's going to come down to getting Iraq stable, but more importantly, and we brought up this topic earlier, was the issue of foreign fighters in the country, and them joining the insurgency, the former regime members, and these foreign fighters, these Wahhabists coming in from Saudi Arabia. I think there's a big problem with that people aren't really talking about is that there's two types of terrorists on the planet. There's the practical terrorist who is interested in making his world better, and then there's the apocalyptic terrorists, or these Wahhabists that are coming in and pretty much think that they're living in hell now and that their heaven is going to come when they kill as many, you know, Americans as possible and, you know, and go to paradise and their 72 virgins.
Chris, let me ask you, you say we have to win in Iraq, and many people feel that way. I mean, it would be great to have stability there and not to have it be a hornet's nest of terrorists, as General Traynor says. But here we've got Rod Nordland saying, you know, the primary mission of U.S. forces there is at this point self-defense at any cost. And General Traynor and others saying it is becoming, it is a magnet for terrorists. So are we winning or are we not?
It's a test of wills, and with the right attitude from the American people, and with the right resolve from our military and from our administrations, it is something that we'll win. It's going to take time. It's going to be messy. This is with the U.S. has never fought a war like this before. And
Chris, our time is short, and I've got your point there, General Traynor. I want to get your last thought on that. A test of wills, a test of American resolve. I hear you saying something different, unless I misunderstand.
Yeah, well, no, I agree. I think it is. That's a good phrase. It is a test of wills. But I have to say that, you know, our interest in the battle does not match the interest of those who are in part of the insurgency, which spawns suicide bombers. So if you're just going to make any sort of mathematical analysis, you'd say that on some that their will is going to be stronger than ours. But there's no question of it. It is a test of wills, but the test of wills has to be translated into capable policies and programs and capabilities which support what the goal of your particular will. And that, I think, is open to question right now.
Open to very big question as we sit here tonight. Well, it's been a remarkable hour, a big eye-opener from the reporting you all have done, from your observations, General Traynor, Brian Bender, your report on exactly what people are saying and thinking beyond the big public message coming out of the White House. I'm grateful to all of you. Brian Bender with the Boston Globe in Washington, thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And General Bernard Traynor, former 3-star Marine Corps general, thank you for being with us tonight, General.
Thank you, Tom.
And Rod Nordland, 2 years in Baghdad, hats off to you. Lots of good service there, and we're very grateful to you for your time tonight. Rod, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Rod Nordland, correspondent-at-large for Newsweek magazine. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.